if someone is trying to emulate me and they think that they are not me because they don't have my results, they need to hear from me that I live all day long with setting some sort of standard, failing, that hurting and feeling this distance, the space between my effort and what I intended to do. And that is my life all day long.
Welcome back to the Impact Entrepreneur Show. My name is Mike Flynn, and I am honored to be your host. Our mission here on the Impact Entrepreneur Show is not just to inspire you, but also to help you tap into and begin to believe in your God-given potential and purpose. That's right, baby. We want you to not only be inspired, but experience breakthrough. And we do that on this podcast by interviewing incredible people who are using their experiences, their skill set, their platforms to have a game-changing impact in the lives of others. And here's the thing. None of these folks are simply sitting back, living a life of leisure. They have things to do, places to go, and lives to impact. Speaking of that, there are a lot of conversations these days revolving around the idea of taking hold of the narrative of your life and not just passively reacting to life, but actively responding to who you are created to be, what you are called to do, and what you are capable of becoming. And as you know, I'm all for it. As you know, and you probably are tired of hearing me talk about, I wrote a book called Master the Key that is all about that. And today I want to introduce you to a new friend who will add to this conversation, who himself has also written a book that talks about this. And this conversation that society's having, I want to introduce you to Logan Gelbrich, a man who has not just asked himself these questions, but embodies his answers to them. Logan is a former professional baseball player for the San Diego Padres, a, quote, functional coach working with Deuce Gym, and the author of Going Right, A Logical Justification for Pursuing Your Dreams. Logan was lucky enough to know that he wanted to be a baseball player from a very young age, and he had the drive to make it happen. But unfortunately, as we all know, professional sports careers often don't have a very long lifespan. So after Logan's professional baseball career was over, he had to ask himself all of these questions again. Luckily, baseball taught Logan to orient toward that which was in his control. So instead of wallowing in a decision which he couldn't change, he focused on what he could do moving forward. Now, finding our next best step in life requires identifying what's at the intersection of our curiosity and commitment. And in Logan's book, he takes a view on this subject. He urges readers to ask themselves, how are you most useful to yourself and to your community? Such a powerful question. I wish I would have thought about that question on my own and actually included it in my book. But nevertheless, we deliver it to you here and so much more. So bust out your pens and paper, take some notes, and brace for impact. So, dude, Logan, as I was telling you, as we were just chatting briefly, this is Monday morning, March 25th, and this morning has kind of started out with a little bit of the case of the Mondays, because I let someone down. I disappointed someone, and it happens to be my daughter, my 11-year-old daughter, Maeve, who I actually have talked about quite a few times on this podcast, because she's such a driven, intrinsically motivated person. And I never want to crush that type of curiosity and dedication and commitment. And it had nothing. And she's, you know, she's pursuing basketball like hardcore, and had nothing to do with that. It actually had to do with the fact that she has always wanted her mother to do her hair for her. She's got long, beautiful hair. And at the same time, my wife had committed to making my 8-year-old son's lunch for school. I mean, it sounds so trivial, but in the mind of like these two kids, it was like this really big deal. And, you know, my son feels like he always is getting the short end of the stick because he's the youngest.
Right.
And my daughter, Maeve, is really eager to
to get to school and to make things happen. And so she felt like my wife was preventing her from that happening. And so I had to sit down with her and like have this conversation that, you know what, Maeve, like basically the world doesn't revolve around mom doing your hair. And you know what? She's like, fine. Mom never has to do my hair ever again.
Yeah, the absolute. There you go.
And I'm like, wait, no, that's not what I was going for. Like, mom enjoys doing your hair. You enjoy mom having... She's like, no, that's it. Mom never has to do my hair ever again. And she was like, dead serious. And so I felt like a little piece of her childhood was over and a little piece of me like died because I was the causal factor there. Have you ever let someone down like that or felt like you've let someone or disappointed someone or not met some unspoken conversation?
I've never let someone down in my life. Yeah, of course I have. I mean, how long is this show? 6 hours? Of course I have. You know, I think the... I love the strategy, by the way. I'm a Maeve fan already. Just nuke the whole situation. You know, like never, ever again will you do my hair. She'll retreat from that position, I feel like. I don't feel like...
Oh, I know she will. I know. She's just so... She's so stubborn and determined. And in fact, I was an athlete in high school and had some potential in college before I blew my knee in high school. And my wife played high school basketball, but none of us were really like intrinsically like motivated in the way that she is. And there's a local basketball coach that lives in our neighborhood and used to coach kids, but mm-hmm. she kind of retired from that. So I bumped into her yesterday and she's like, you know what? I see Maeve out there all day, like every day, practicing by herself. And she's so intrinsically motivated. I need to coach her, you know, want to spend 30 minutes a week with her. And so it's just, you know, anyway, it's...
That's awesome. There's a theory that this generation doesn't have that. And that's really cool that Maeve is going for it.
Yeah. Well, she has Steph Curry and KD and all of those people to thank for that. I mean, she's just an obsessed Warriors fan.
That's cool.
You know, we were... I first was introduced to your work by a couple of your pals, Dr. Kara Miller and Caroline Burkle, and just following you on social. And so I had this profound conversation, two conversations, in fact, with Dr. Miller that we broke up into two episodes, and it was just such a rich conversation. And then, you know, you coming out with your book, Going Right. There is this theme right now happening in, I think, society about really taking hold of the narrative of our life and not necessarily reacting passively, but responding to who we are created to be, what we're called to, and what we're capable of becoming, and engaging in that process. And we're going to talk about that. But before we get into all of the nitty-gritty there, I'm going to kick things off with the same question that I asked Dr. Miller at the beginning of our conversation, which is, who is your childhood hero?
Oh, man. Well, let's see here. I was an odd kid. So, yeah, I was an athlete, but I was one of these weird young athletes that didn't have the player that I really emulated too much. But there's one exception, and I'm calling it an exception because he retired. I must have been 8 years old when he retired, but Nolan Ryan was my favorite player of all time. And there's a cool full circle moment there. But anyway, I was fascinated with him and his sort of personality on the field and his style. You know, most legendary power pitcher of all time, potentially. But other than that, I thought my dad was the coolest guy on the planet. And, you know, I saw models around my life, but I didn't turn the corner on really being a fan of too many folks outside of this Nolan Ryan.
Mm-hmm. What actually about Nolan Ryan spoke to or drew you in? What would he do? Was it his intensity? Was it his fire? Was it his nature? What was it?
He was just a dominant force. I emulated his pitching windup. Actually, had this big over the top like leg kick thing. If you know anything about Nolan Ryan, you could make a case that they don't make them like they used to, kind of thing. He would be in triple digits, 100 miles an hour plus for 9 innings and just compete, you know. And he wasn't afraid to, you know, there's a personality trait, if I'm going to generalize with pitchers, that they're a little soft and they're a little timid and they're a little particular. He was the opposite of that. He pitched like someone would play football, you know, and it was just exciting to me. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a cool thing to look up to.
Where did your love of baseball come from? Was it from watching those guys, or was it from your dad?
I mean, most directly with my dad and just playing as a kid, but, you know, maybe like Maeve, I think I had this uniquely intrinsic relationship with it. You know, I had the opposite of the overbearing sort of parent thing. I wasn't pushed by coaches, or like no one could have peer pressured me to want that more than I wanted it for myself. And so I'm not sure what that was, but I sort of decided at a very young age that I was going to do anything to realize this sort of thing.
Did that kind of spill over into every other area of your life as well? Academics, relationships, growing up?
Yeah. You know, I think when I look back, and I've said this for a long time, that I feel very grateful that I had a clear vision in my head at such a young age. You know, I sympathize with and this sort of can get into the book eventually, but it's like, I sympathize with the position of like, I just don't know. I don't know what I want to do. You know, I'm not familiar with that feeling. Mm-hmm. Because at such a young age, I had this long form journey of a goal. And then as soon as my career was over, the period in which there was any uncertainty was pretty short. I mean, we're talking like less than a year. To where I like engaged in another long-term sort of arduous task, you know? And so, yeah, it spilled over everywhere. I mean, at age maybe 13, I was vocalizing outwardly to people that, you know, every decision I make is towards this thing, including school. Like I was an excellent student by like numbers, you know, but I'd be lying if I said I wasn't an excellent student just for the sake of being an excellent student. You know, mm-hmm. I just knew that if I could get into every college in the country, then it would just, in terms of optionality, it would help out the baseball career
thing. Yeah. You know, I actually don't think that most people actually really believe that they don't know what they want to do. I think that they know what they want to do, but they're afraid that if they say it, what it might cost them.
Yeah, well, this is the impetus of the book. I mean, I am with you. The way I often describe it is that it's such a universal human experience to wonder what it is that you should do with your time here, that mm-hmm. I'm just sort of searching for who these people are that are just never asking themselves that question. You know, they just look up one day and they're like, oh my God, like I should probably figure out what I should do. Like, I don't believe that that's a thing. I think we're on the same page.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that we are all competitors with, and many of us just aren't awake to that. And life is this sort of competition game, and it's not necessarily a competition where you're trying to beat someone else. It's this idea of really focusing on becoming who you are created to be and competing against the forces around you, be it mental, emotional, physical, spiritual, that are trying to prevent you from realizing that. And I had this guy a long time ago on the show. He's a business consultant named Dan Waldschmidt. And he said that, it still sticks with me, one of the things he said. He said, everybody likes the idea of competition, but when the gun goes off, it gets real, right? Like when you have to engage in the process of realizing your dream of becoming a professional baseball player and then getting a phone call that says your career as a professional baseball player is done and having to pivot, like that's a gunshot moment where, okay, it gets real again.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, what was that moment like when you did, you had reached your goal of becoming a professional baseball player, not only a professional baseball player, but you're from Southern California, right? You're from the San Diego area, right?
I'm from Los Angeles, but more or less.
So you get to, but you went to USD. So you got to play for the Padres, right? So it's like not only professional baseball player, but hometown team, like, you know, dream of dreams. And then it's short lived.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of a surreal thing to reflect on. And I think I feel very fortunate that I just so happened to fall in love with this game that is so rich with lessons that are highly transferable. And I would make a case that any sport or any, you know, pursuit in mastery would yield these highly transferable skills, but baseball is pretty ruthless about that. I mean, there's so many variables outside of your control. There's so much failure just sort of woven into the thing that you become quite stoic, and almost like there's a winner's circle bias there. I mean, there's very few people who make it to that level that are just on some emotional roller coaster. It just doesn't pay. You'd have to be so gifted and talented and good at the sport to bring that type of liability with you. And so the reason why I say that is, like, you know, you get a call that, you know, if I take myself out of my own shoes and sort of, you know, evaluate this moment where, okay, here's a young man who's devoted 20 years full on to this thing, more or less. I mean, call it 15 or 10 years really full on, where every decision is sort of oriented in this direction. And then it all goes away. It feels sad. It feels like, you know, traumatic, maybe, this big pivot. And to be honest, in the moment, it was pretty anticlimactic. You know, of course I was sad. Of course there was some uncertainty. I didn't know if I would attempt to re-sign and continue my career, or if that really was the end. And the reason for me sort of highlighting how anticlimactic it was is it felt that way because at that point in my life, I was the most oriented with that which was in my control. And I was as good as I'd ever been in my life, trained to relinquish some sort of harboring of things outside of my control. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you can't make a living in as a hitter, at least in baseball, mixing up those signals, you know? And so that's some information that I got that was in that moment in the past, and we were going to make decisions going forward. And it sounds like you kind of want to maybe like roll your eyes, like, okay, here we go. It's a corny thing. But like, that's really the place which I live, and I would argue that all of my teammates lived as well.
Now, you were and are definitely more aware than many people about the importance of paying attention to those signals and your thought life and all of these things. And you did that kind of, you've done that from the beginning, but one poignant moment that actually Dr. Kara Miller shares in the forward to your book is when you walked into her classroom at USD and you wanted to pursue becoming a better leader in her classroom, but your baseball schedule didn't work with the curriculum, and because you were so driven and motivated, she worked on your behalf. You, you took her class, but then did you carry on having her coach you as you began to embark on your professional career? And what, how did that play in your ability to pivot?
Yeah. So meeting Dr. Miller happened in my senior year at the University of San Diego, and just how it worked out was such that based on, you know, whatever AP credits in high school and whatnot, that I had enough room in my schedule to potentially take on a minor with my business degree. And so, yeah, rather than take like a bunch of ceramics classes or whatever, PE or something like that, I wanted to take advantage of this new leadership school that they built. Felt pretty relevant. And the capstone course is this course called Leadership Seminar, and she was the professor. It just so happened to be in the spring of my senior year, which was the first year that the NCAA created this uniform start date. So all of the Division I programs in the country for baseball would start their season on the same weekend. And this was a mechanism to try to make the non-fair weather schools a little bit more competitive. You know, we, our first game would be like the last weekend of January, where like, you know, if you played to Boston College or something like that, you'd have to play on the road for the first 2 months or whatever. Long story short, this made our sort of 56 games still occur, but in a shorter amount of time. And so I just could never make it to the capstone course. And I was, you know, I knew I'd be playing professional baseball the next year, and I just wasn't going to take a fifth year of college for like a scheduling conflict, you know? So I figured it was worth asking the question. The administration wasn't really willing to budge, and I don't really blame them for that. But I happened to pass by Dr. Miller's desk, and she was there, and I just explained the story really briefly. She went to bat for me. I didn't really hear the full story until, you know, almost 10 years later, but we got this independent study. So basically I did the course with her in her office one-on-one at times that it worked. And that was a profound experience, you know, because there's really no place to hide when you're taking an upper end college course one-on-one with your professor, you know? And so that pushed me, and I really connected with the material in ways that I wouldn't have otherwise. And so that just sort of left a cool mark on me. We generally stayed in touch, but quite frankly, throughout my playing career and then even the transition after, you know, we weren't like in constant contact. It wasn't mm-hmm. until several years ago that we linked back up. She was up in LA, and I mentioned, this is almost 4 years ago now, I mentioned this book project. And so there's a gap, is what I'm saying, in this sort of communication. And I sort of formally invited her into that process because she offered in this conversation, hey, if you ever need any help, let me know. And so I wanted to write this book, and she would be literally the best person on the planet to help me with this thing. And so I casually offered, you know, if she would take a look at some of the things I'd written. After sending that email, I immediately decided that that was a poor choice and that I needed to enroll myself fully into this thing. And just background, after Dr. Miller leaves USC, she goes on to Harvard and doing things in the private sector that are just, you know, extremely impressive. And yeah. So here I am, this kid who's trying to hire one of the most powerful consultants that I know, you know, and so I just told her, I said, hey, I need you to draft up an invoice, and I need you to make it hurt, and let's do this thing proper, because I don't want a half-ass effort from you either. And so, yeah, I fully hired her. It was the most money I've ever spent on anything at that point in my life. And now we've sort of rekindled a strong friendship and a coaching relationship and a working relationship that is one of the most cherished kind of bonds I have in my life.
Here we are, my friends, another week in the launch of Master the Key, and the book continues to impact. It continues to get really incredible reviews on Amazon. It continues to build momentum, and now we are building opportunities to gain press coverage. If you know anybody that is interested in featuring the book in the press, and is interested in purpose and potential and meaning and life and adding inspiration into a dark and confused world, then I want you to reach out to me because I want to talk to them. I want to meet to them. And if you are a leader in an organization where the other leaders of that organization are interested in developing the purpose of their people, then I want to meet them too. But right now, what I want you to do is hit pause, head over to Amazon, and pick up yourself a copy of the paperback version of Master the Key, A Story to Free Your Potential, Find Meaning, and Live Life on Purpose. You will not regret it. The book is transformational. And when you engage with the questions that are four parts of the book, you will be deeply and profoundly touched and changed. My recommendation is that you read the book once all the way through, and then you go back through the workbook section and you actually engage with those questions independently. So go ahead and hit pause, head over to Amazon, do that, and then come back and finish listening to the conversation I have with the incredible Logan.
You actually just alluded to something that you actually talk about in the book, which is what happens when curiosity meets with commitment. And I think that is a really interesting and very powerful part of the book where people don't allow those two very important characteristics to meet and to engage with each other. So why is it so important that not only that we allow our curiosity to exist and to play with it, but to also allow it to meet with commitment?
Well, this is a cart before the horse issue. If you don't marry curiosity to commitment, then is it really commitment? It's sort of like, this is a position that people get themselves in all the time, right? If they hear some spiel or some pep rally or some motivation to maximize their time here. You know, I want to make an impact and go for it. Okay. So I need to commit to something, obviously, right? So let's commit to, pottery making. That's it. We're going to commit to this ceramic and this arbitrary thing is most specifically a cart before the horse issue. You can't have this positive connotation with a word like commitment and then just step into it. That's not how that works. It's not how it works in relationships, not how it works in careers, not how it works in hobbies or anything. And so the entry point to anything that you could commit to in a fashion that would pay big dividends in joy or money or whatever it is that you're talking about would have to start with genuine curiosity. You know, the book ultimately isn't really interested in the emotional side of this. It's interested in the objective utilitarian view of how we're most useful to ourselves and our communities. And I know that the commitment required for your best effort in anything, and my best effort in anything, is a genuine one that is rooted much deeper than something arbitrary, right? I cannot decide, okay, let's put some ideas in a hat, pull one out, and then you and I are going to commit to the next 10 years of developing a nonprofit around that idea. Like, that doesn't come with the weight required of the path there. And so, most people understand the importance of commitment, and then feel like, well, this is just a choice. I should be committed to something, therefore I'll just choose something. And so you have to nurture that gateway. You know, you have to be curious about what lights you up, what interests you, what you could potentially commit to down the road. And that's all self-selecting, right? If I'm curious about something, I go check it out. I get a week and a half into it. I can change my mind, right? But if I just decide arbitrarily that we're going to do this ceramics thing, I'm just like completely belabored by this 3 months in. I mean, what type of work am I putting into that? Right? How easy or difficult is it for me to put in quote unquote overtime with that? Right. And that's the reason for that connection.
Mm-hmm. What are some questions that when people find themselves waffling in their commitment, even if they have this connection to it, right? It's what you're doing, right? It's what you're doing with Deuce and with hold the Standard Summit and all of the work that you're doing. When people find themselves waffling in their commitment, maybe they're not even waffling. Maybe it's just because they're tired. But what are some questions when they feel like their commitment is waning that they should explore?
Well, I think we should always explore. I think those things are not necessarily at odds with each other. I think inside of commitment, and this sort of gets to the next sort of amenity of going right, is if you're that committed to something, then the next obvious question is, well, what are the best practices here? Mm-hmm. Right? Like, am I just spending time here or is this time effective? And so if you're truly committed to anything, that commitment sort of begs the question of how is it that you're going about your business? And this is where you get the benefit of commitment, which is the opportunity to build this large body of deep work, mm-hmm. right? You know, like you would hope that if we somehow committed to this ceramic idea that I just sort of made up earlier, that, well, that commitment would yield eventually that we'd be pretty damn good at it, right? Like there's no use in a long-term, deep-rooted commitment into a practice that just like doesn't yield anything. Like if I'm horrible at spinning pottery on the wheel, so to speak, it seems like an odd thing to commit to. These things are tethered to each other. And so we know that not all time spent with a craft is created equal. Right? Some time is just more effective than others. And this gets into, you know, various models out there, but you know, the classic big ones are deliberate practice and deep work. People who are really committed to their craft just so happen to practice and spend time with their craft better than non-committed people. Mm-hmm. And that is inherently valuable. That process is inherently rewarding. That process inherently recycles commitment, right? Mm-hmm. It feels good to be good at things. It feels good to create value. You know, like, 7-year-old me commits to baseball. Well, it's easier to stay committed to baseball when you're just better than everybody at it because you've worked so hard at it, you know? And so, yeah, but you know, this sort of comes with the caveat of sure, you can always change your mind. You know, you can always realize this is not something that you want for yourself anymore. It's totally fair.
Have you, you know, it's evident in your book, in the stories that you tell, in your professional pursuits, both as an athlete and as a businessman, in your relationships, it's obvious that you are in this intense pursuit and, you know, pushing the envelope on what you're capable of doing. Do you ever find it challenging for yourself to remain present in that pursuit?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I could see that showing up. I don't want to, like, my gut reaction was to answer straight away in a way that might sound like I'm just wanting to say the positive thing all the time. But I'll provide some context. I am very process oriented, to maybe to a detriment. Maybe the pendulum has swung so far in that direction that there's some shadow fallout there. Totally aware of some of that and open to that idea. But I live inside of this process orientation because of my relationship with baseball specifically as the only way that I can accomplish anything. Like I don't have any delusions about like some innate talent to just be good at things. Right. And so my experience of the world is that I rarely look up to see what the scoreboard looks like, I rarely look up to see kind of where I'm at. My process orientation, almost to the detriment of like goal setting and being clear on destinations, is a place that I think keeps me in the moment. I mean, to the point where I don't really keep a calendar well, you know, because in my head, the fit, and this was sort of, you know, reinforced by the baseball thing, is like, you know, I was a type of player that wouldn't know what time the game started or who we were playing. You know, friends would say, "Hey, can you leave me some tickets? Like, what time's the game?" Like, I don't know. I'll be there at 11 when batting practice starts. You know, like that. It doesn't pay for me to know this stuff, you know.
Right.
Where are you guys playing this weekend? I don't know. And this is way too hard for me to focus on not Wednesday. Right. Mm-hmm. And so the reason why I provide that context is I don't want to sound like I'm like the model who like knows it all or whatever, but I think I live in the moment, because that's the only place I can really operate. Now, if I'm going to critique myself, it would be that I generally am unaware of the results. And I'm disengaged with that a lot. That would be the downside.
Well, I think that, you know, competitors and high performers kind of share that. I had Jason Kalipa on the show a few episodes back, and I asked him a similar question, and he said he just came out with a book called The AMRAP Mentality.
Yeah.
And he really does try to apply that AMRAP to every encounter that he's having, so that he can remain present. So he's like, "Mike, I'm here with you. I'm trying to do as many reps with you as I can right now. Nothing else matters except for this very moment." And I think that it's such an important lesson that those who aren't competitors, who aren't in, who don't believe they're competitors, because I believe that we're all competing at some level, but those that don't believe they're competitors, those that just believe they're sitting in the stands watching.
Yeah. They're regular. They're normal.
They're normal. Yeah. They need, you know, they are so concerned with all of the things happening around them that they're not aware of what's happening within them. Right.
Totally. And this is a thing that, you know, awareness is hard, right? Because the folks who need it most don't have it. Therefore, they rarely get the messages that might be most rich for them. And that's a whole conundrum rabbit hole that we could go down. But, you know, we should at least be aware that we can learn principled, important lessons at the fringes, right? So to use our example of like the quote unquote regular people who don't believe they're competitors, tend to operate on bad information. Yeah, the book starts with that premise, actually, that like we're making the biggest decisions in our lives on bad information, because we've created this decision-making model that like what would elicit our peak expression and drive our call them dreams or best self is at odds with what is reasonable. And so if you live in that worldview, like why would you ever choose the former, right? And so I bet Jason would tell you that, you know, it's not about the rep, not about CrossFit, not about the thrusters or the front squat, but how is it that he went through a high level, rigorous expression of that and comes out on the other side and says, "Hey, you know what's really about? It's about mastering what's inside your control, living inside the moment, you know, these are general lessons, you know, that has nothing to do with hitting a curveball, but like I'm over here preaching to the same choir." Right. Mm-hmm. And so these, call them fringe pursuits, all lead to the same sort of generalized important extraction lessons from them. And it's because that the environment, the feedback loops inside of starting a business, inside of fighting for your life on a battlefield, inside of a high level expression of a sport, all these fringe things demand the best practices.
Mm-hmm.
So can't we look to these fringe examples, whether you're there or not, you can look to how these people behave and orient yourself with the processes and truths and principles that may serve you in any other context, right? It's like, why are all those people having the same conversation? And then folks in the middle, folks who were saying don't believe their competitors and are quote unquote normal, have a misguided view of that thing. One of the most common ones I talk about is if you believe that excellence, if we're going to say Jason is an example of excellence, which he is, and you're just a regular person, your worldview might make Jason some kind of other. Mm-hmm. Like he's different than me. And he's excellent. He's famous and he's really fit, like way fitter than I could ever be. He's rich. He's really smart. He's all these other things. But I'm this normal person. Mm-hmm. And what this worldview does is it builds up a sort of a false evaluation tool. Because if I believe that excellence looks like that, and that his experience is just slam dunks all day, he tries something and he wins. Look at this guy's experience. He enrolls in this thing and he's on the podium. Right? He tries to lift the weight and the weight goes up. Right? From this vantage point, it seems like excellent people experience excellence all the time. Victory. They try something and it goes well. Except for if you really ask Jason what his experience of the world is, it would not be that. He is actually highly aware of all of his deviations from what we call is the standard or what he's trying to do. Mm-hmm. Ask any artist the same thing. Right? Mm-hmm. I used to be so upset. I love art. And as a kid, I would love to draw. And I would be so upset because I would try to draw a circle or a straight line. And it wouldn't be straight. And the circle wouldn't be perfect. And I would say, well, see, obviously, this is not what I intended to draw. The mistake isn't in that. The mistake is in assuming that the people that you want to emulate are not experiencing their own level of dissatisfaction all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, the easy example I talk about often in the summit is, you know, Michael Jordan. Pick the greatest of all time in anything. We'll say Michael Jordan. You know, you look at this guy and you think that his experience is all about meeting his expectation. Mm-hmm. When we know that if you really got inside the mind of Michael Jordan, his experience of most every shot he takes, every pass down the court, every game, a reflection on a season, is one that is riddled with disappointment. He attempted to score 100 points and he scored 60. We think he's the greatest of all time. And that was the perfect game. And he recognizes all of these dissatisfactions that we don't see. Right. And so if you are quote unquote normal, you might think that any deviation from your expectation then is a signal that you are still normal. You are still a failure. You are still not excellent. Right. When in fact, the best in the world at whatever they do have a different relationship with that failure. Right? They use it as information to move closer to their vision, their standard, what it is they're trying to do. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I just find that it's important that people who are emulated, people who are excellent, share that full truth. Like if someone is trying to emulate me and they think that they are not me because they don't have my results, they need to hear from me that I live all day long with setting some sort of standard, failing, that hurting and feeling the distance, the space between my effort and what I intended to do. And that is my life all day long. Mm-hmm. And that revisiting that is the process, that thing that we all roll our eyes at and that we say, you know, way too much and don't really know what we're saying.
This episode is brought to you by the Lawton Marketing Group, a full-service advertising and design agency specializing in websites, social media, apps, logos, and more. Based in Oklahoma, they work with clients across the nation from small businesses to large corporations and everything in between. You can find them right now on the web at www.lawtonmg.com or call them at 580-275-2063. Connect with them now for a complimentary competitive analysis of your website. Just tell them the Impact Entrepreneur told you to call.
You know, one of the things I just kind of had this revelation, but or idea that popped into my head as you were talking about one of the things that connects high performers or people that are, you know, realizing what they're capable of is that you kind of have kind of two types of people that I'm referring to. And I'm just kind of playing this idea out as we're recording, but I thought about, you know, people like yourself and Jason Kalipa and all of these great athletes, Caroline, you know, all of the people that work out at Deuce and do hard things, they've chosen some sort of adversity, right? They've made a decision to do something very hard. On the other end of that spectrum are people that actually didn't necessarily make a choice, but nevertheless experience some adversity. If you think, the thing that came to my mind is like somebody like in World War II who was drafted into the war, right? They didn't necessarily have a choice, but nevertheless they were thrust into a very difficult situation. And I was thinking about that movie, this HBO series, The Band of Brothers, yeah. and how there's that one lieutenant who was always charging out like into the fire, right? And everybody thought he was nuts, but he would always come back. And so one guy asks him at one point, like, why are you doing that? You're going to die, you know? And he said, you see, the difference between you and me is that you still think you're alive, you know?
So big.
And it's how you play.
Totally. Well, the equivalent of this in a decision-making framework, and this is what's presented in the book, is that's so perfect, is the equivalent of you still think you're alive is you believe that there is safety in one of these choices.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's the book about is like this crossroads between choosing your peak expression or conceding that for some sort of
normal,
quote unquote, normal, respectable, reasonable, logical, socially reinforced thing, safer thing. And that is the fallacy, that is the least safe thing that you could do, because there is no upside there. There is only downside. And like you said, some people seek out adversity. I'm not saying that we all need to seek out adversity. I think it'd be a good idea. But what I am saying is life is going to dole it out regardless of your choices, right? So it seems like it'd be, you know, at least logical in a strict sense to choose some sort of direction that has upside, right? In the career is the easiest way to think about it. There are many people listening to this podcast right now who are enrolled inside of call it a career, simply because they believe that it is safe.
Mm-hmm.
You are not safe. The only certainty in the world that you and I live in is uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it seems like the most fragile thing you could do is enroll decades of your life passively in a career that isn't driving your evolution. Mm-hmm. Because you know, the career that was trending when you got in isn't trending at the end. And then now all of a sudden your thing goes out of business or some external environment changes. And how unfit are you now for the world that you are thrust into? You know, mm-hmm. Not that I'm the model, but like you asked earlier about the call. When I got the call from, you know, the Padres are no longer requesting your services, I would argue that, again, it has nothing to do with throwing a baseball 90 miles an hour or hitting a baseball 400 feet. These are not the skills I'm talking about. But how I chose to go about that pursuit made me the most fit for whatever it is that I wanted to do after that. Now, it's possible to be in that same seat and to be a baseball player and have gone about it in a different way that would make me extremely unfit for that. But this is an illusion. And that's a great reference, the Band of Brothers one, whether you believe you're alive or not, you're not technically safe in either of these choices. Mm-hmm. And so the most logical choice then, the only choice you really have, is to choose one that presents some sort of upside. If you want to cement your place of sort of undercut value, if you want to cement that reality, then yeah, you can choose the one that's seemingly safe, but that is subject to the same uncertainty.
Well, it ties into another quote that I mean, you could, like, this quote from your book could just like print this on 226 pages and that could be the whole book. And it says, success is fully tethered to failure. If we're all going to struggle, it seems that we ought to struggle in the places that make us better, doing the activities that bring us joy with the people that help us grow, period. Right?
Yeah.
Like that's the whole book, basically. I mean, like that could be the whole book. There's a lot more to it.
Yeah.
But I think that the other thing that is really important and that should not be lost in that paragraph that you wrote there is the difference between joy and happiness. Joy doesn't always equal being happy.
Yeah. Happiness is a positive emotion, which is mutually exclusive of joy.
Right.
Right.
And I think that's powerful. And because you're doing something that brings you joy, when you know that you are honoring the creation that you are, you can withstand a lot more hardship.
Oh, surely. I mean, that, and this is almost like you're doing this on purpose, but the this deep, rich work that we know elicits some sort of joy isn't always happy, doesn't always experience the positive emotion of happiness. It's just a little bit deeper than that. That leads to this next amenity of what we're saying is this model of going right, which is that folks who are deeply committed and build a large body of deep work, by definition, then are more resilient to adversity,
mm-hmm.
which is what you just said. You're more fortified then. You're more fit for the uncertain world that you live in. And, you know, who would you rather have next to you when, you know, things go bad, right? Who would you rather walk down a dark alley with, be in, you know, an episode of Band of Brothers with, or experience the financial catastrophe with, than someone who has continually chosen to operate at the edge of their capacity,
mm-hmm.
committed, curious about doing the deep work? I wouldn't want to fair weather kind of seeking front runner mentality next to me in those situations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we see this all the time. The best teams in the world, it's no coincidence that that's a common trait, because the best teams in the world happen to be presented with adversity. Like ritualistically, that's what that is. You know, SEAL teams don't go and do arm wrestling competitions. They go into the hardest, nastiest, most dangerous situations. They're also the most fit for that. You know, the best baseball teams in the world have to play against the other best baseball teams in the world. You know, and so it's sort of like this is an unmistakable truth that we're all facing. It's like, I mean, hate to be the bearer of bad news, but it's going to go bad for us at some point on different levels, different ways. This is part of life.
Mm-hmm.
I would hope that we would go about our lives in ways that fortify us for that rather than make us more fragile for that.
There's this great quote from Augustine, who is, you know, a philosopher, Catholic saint and spiritual writer. And one of the things he says is, do not wander far and wide from yourself, but return to yourself, for deep within man dwells the truth. And I think that's such a, I mean, it just, I read that not too long ago and it just really resonated with me. So when you think about the truth that you are trying to draw out from yourself, how would you describe it?
Well, I'm definitely on my own path to seek it. I think the best mirrors that we can buy are the pursuits that confront us. You know, I learn who I am with engagement and work that continually question who I am. And so I think a lot of us are intentionally avoiding difficulty, and as a result are sort of losing ourselves along the way, you know, in terms of my truth. I don't know. I think I'm learning who I am, and I'm learning that there's a lot of things that really serve me and have served me, and I have certain results to show for it. But, you know, one of the most recent kind of learnings I've had with this is that our best attributes have shadows, you know, and then there's potential downside. You know, one of the things I would have told you if you interviewed me and asked me this question, I don't know, 5-10 years ago, it would be like, I am the hardest working person I know. I'm willing to fail. I'm willing to do the hard thing, yada, 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 all kinds of cool, fluffy stuff. And in my mind, that would be only positive, right? Only positive upside. But now with more awareness, I can see that my favorite tools in my toolkit also can come with shadows, consequences, impact, you know? And so what that looks like is, yeah, I'm willing to do hard work and be accountable, allegedly. But with that can come a propensity to feel shame, propensity to not nurture myself, right? And so with a fuller awareness around that, I can now engage with my world, my life, with greater accuracy, better practices, you know? And so, but I'll tell you this, I could have gone the next 50 years never knowing that. If I believe that the idea of my life is to seek comfort and safety, you only get presented with these beautiful lessons by delving into your edge, your fringe. You know, mm-hmm. I'm really interested in what I can't yet do, what I can't yet see. Mm-hmm. And the only things that are going to show me that and teach me those things are hanging out there on the mm-hmm. edge.
And I think that a lot of people, for a lot of people, that edge is going to be going within, right? The place that they're most afraid to go, it's not to the gym. It's not to, you know, the water. It's to the cave within them, you know, which as Joseph Campbell says, is where the treasure lies, right? Mm-hmm. And I think if we all just take time to pause, to reflect, to look at our narrative, to look at what has happened to us, but allow it to, for a moment, also happen for us, we can learn and experience things in a rich way.
Totally. And it's a beautiful coincidence, at least if you're in my line of work, the beautiful coincidence that the behaviors that would orient themselves, someone in that way, where they're looking inward, are the exact behaviors that emulate leadership. You know, followership mentality, I end up like poo-pooing followership, and I don't want that to be misunderstood. I view leadership as a teachable skill. I mean, if you believe that leadership is a teachable skill where anybody can take up accountability for the results that are outside of their control, then everybody can technically be in leadership. If you have that skill, you can use it, or you don't have to use it. It's a measure of capacity. You know, if I can deadlift 600 pounds, then that means I can deadlift 600 pounds. Mm-hmm. If I can only deadlift 100 pounds, I can't deadlift 600 pounds. Right? Mm-hmm. But if I have the ability to deadlift 600 pounds, I can do other things below that. You see what I'm saying? Leadership is that way as well. If you have the teachable skill of leadership, then you can follow and you can lead. If you do not, you can only follow. And there's a line around the block for people who are willing to be followers. And the line is much shorter for leadership. And it, in my opinion, it's no coincidence that the place and the behavior that lends to our growth most emulates that of leadership. Mm-hmm. How am I responsible for this? What about me can improve to take ownership of this thing? What about these results are my doing, right? Whereas folks who are uninterested in signing up for the teachable skill of leadership have a lot of reasons outside of themselves for the results of that.
Yeah, no, I love that. And, you know, I think that if people are just aware of where they are at and acknowledge that, I love the analogy you used about the deadlift and about deadlifting the person who can deadlift 600 versus the person that can only deadlift 100. But if someone is looking at you deadlifting 600 pounds and they're only able to deadlift 100 pounds, they're going to have two reactions. And this is going back to that whole thing earlier, like, oh, Logan is special. I'm just normal, right?
Yeah.
But as we know from psychology, like Dr. Albert Bandura's work on self-efficacy and all of that stuff, we can build up the ability to deadlift 600 pounds. We can earn that confidence by seeing ourselves in a position where we could deadlift 600 pounds and then reverse engineering or following a process to get to that place. And I think that's where most people stop, though. Like,
it's where most people stop, and it goes back to what I was saying before, is that in these two characters that I'm envisioning in my head, you've I'm very grateful you've assigned me the 600-pound deadlift and someone else the 100-pound deadlift, right? But the character who then is, you're saying, looking at me, might not, and it sounds like the way you're telling the story, it seems like what they don't understand is that the relative burden for me to put 5 pounds on that lift is a very similar relative burden for them, right? And now we're actually playing the same game.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right? And so this is a matter of absolute versus relative understanding, right? As those people in an absolute sense see, like, well, I'm not that, therefore this is stupid and I shouldn't pursue it. The beauty of being a process-oriented individual is that it brings a relative responsibility to the scenario, which is the behaviors that move the 100-pound deadlift to 115-pound deadlift is the same mechanism and burden and challenge and vulnerability that it takes to move the 600-pound deadlift up as well. You know, and this is the reason why high performers across all disciplines tend to have this mutual respect. You know, this is like a new theory of mine. It's like, found myself at dinner tables and certain things that I've said out loud, like, how did I get here kind of thing. And when you're around high performing people, what I've realized is that despite what I originally thought, which is that celebrities and famous people and champions hang out with each other because that's what celebrities do, it's almost none of that. It's a mutual respect for the vulnerability of their pursuit of their craft. You look across the room at someone who has an Academy Award, and if you're a Wimbledon champion or whatever your story is, you don't need to be an actor to appreciate that feedback loop of facing this sort of discomfort and pursuing the excellence and failing and continuing to pursue it. Whereas the regular person, in your example, the 100-pound deadlift person, just looks at the 600-pound thing and just says, well, obviously I'm not that, therefore this is a different conversation. Isn't it ironic that the high performer is like, no, we're doing the same thing. I can literally cheer and appreciate and be as emotionally involved in your pursuit of moving the needle on this thing as I am of my pursuit. You know, and that's a tragedy, I think, and it goes back to sort of followership behavior, right? Is if you explain away your results to something external, then of course, this is a deterministic view. Of course, well, why would I do this? Things out of my hand.
Have you ever heard of a guy named Eli Bremer? He's a former Olympic pentathlete, you know, Air Force guy, you know, officer, now represents the sports performance marketing team for Shaqley, which is a supplemental organization. Anyway, one of the things he told me about his Olympic pursuits was the biggest game-changing impact that he witnessed was the Winter Olympics when Apollo Ohno was skating for a gold, and he was in this tight pack, and this Korean ice skater slipped, and you know everybody that was in that tight grouping fell with him, and then this Australian guy who was in last place skates through to win gold. That was a really important lesson for him, because you know that yes, the Australian ended up winning gold, but then Apollo Ohno went on to become the most highly decorated Winter Olympic athlete of all time. And Eli had this epiphany that he had to stop trying to win and start trying to be good.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
That's the scary burden that anybody who has awareness to performance realizes that is never over. There's no finish line. The best in the world, if they're in pursuit of that, are feeling this relative burden of how do I, you know, put 1 pound more on the bar or skate 5 seconds faster or whatever the case may be. And that is something that followers want to explain away, right? Like, no, they're there. They're just elite. That's what they're just there celebrating their eliteness. Like, no, this is a vulnerable act. The same type of vulnerable act that you could choose to embark in or not, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, and it literally never goes away. People make the same error when they look at great performers in anything, you know, so LeBron James, you know, it's like, well, if LeBron James is the best in the game, then his practices must be the best practices. It's like, well, we don't know. The better question is, what's the best version of LeBron James? Mm-hmm. You know, and if you ask that question, which I guarantee you he's asking, then it opens up all kinds of curiosity. Oh, shoot. Well, maybe the way I'm training can be improved, and the way that I'm hydrating can be improved, and the way that I'm eating can be improved. Right. But when followers don't do that, they say, oh, he's the best in the game. So if he squats on Monday, I squat on Monday. If he runs sprints on Tuesday, I run sprints on Tuesday. Like, no, the highest performing question would be a relative one. What's the best version of me
mm-hmm.
possible? Mm-hmm. You know, and if you ask that question, then there's no finish line and this thing mm-hmm. spirals forward forever.
Mm-hmm. Logan, I want to say thank you for joining us and for sharing your pursuit and sharing your insight with us on the Impact Entrepreneur Show. And I look forward to continuing to get to know you and maybe collaborating again in the future. But before we go, I want to make sure that people can connect with you, where they can go get the book, interact with Deuce and Hold the Standard and all of that stuff.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me on. This is awesome. I'm on the internet at, you know, all the social media things at Functional Coach, my handle. Holdthestandard.com is where you can find all like the online education things, courses that develop coaches around the world and courses that develop entrepreneurship. And then also the Hold the Standard Summit, which is a 2-day course I teach around the world. That's about it. I like to interact with folks. So if you send me a message, I'll definitely write you back. And the book is slated to officially drop April 4th, but the pre-sales have been crazy. It's number one new release in its category of philosophy, and just trying to share a message that I think is the most important message out there, because it is centered around how you make the most important decisions in your life. And I think no one is exempt from that.
I love it. Well, I always conclude every conversation, and we'll be sure to link to all of those things in the show notes. I always conclude the conversation with 3 questions for every single guest, and they're the same 3 questions. So the first is, if you could pick any skill set that you currently possess and turn it into a superpower, what would it be?
Empathy, or to take it one step further, seeing other perspectives. I think our lens of the world, I know that our lens of the world is a very ineffective, small, inaccurate view of the truth. Mm-hmm. And that if we could aggregate a better truth with more perspectives, then we could all make better decisions and communicate better and get to something more tangible. And so if we could turn on this sort of perspective shifting thing, then I think that inherently is a superpower.
I think Stephen Covey once said, it's in Seven Habits, it's one of the principles, is like, seek first to understand, right, before seeking to be understood. It's really great. Also, another similar version is this priest that was giving a sermon said that the problem with love is that everyone is trying to be loved first. Mm. I'm like, dang, dude, that's so true. the next question is, what are three lies that we tell ourselves that prevent us from realizing what we're capable of?
It's just the way that I am. One, I think in general, it just never pays to have a deterministic attitude. You know, people go down the rabbit hole of the nature versus nurture thing, even as specific as like athleticism, you know, it just never pays. Even if it's true that you're just, some people are gifted and some people aren't, even if it's true that like there's some sort of gene expression that just makes certain people get certain success, it just doesn't pay to believe that to be true. It only pays to sort of do what you can to maximize your thing. Second is, this is a general one, but I think it's a heavy one, that it's not my fault. And what I mean by that is, imagine a world where we all pointed the finger inward. Wherever the conflict, wherever the disagreement, whatever the incidents, whatever the results are, if we all looked inward about what our responsibility for that was, we would just be way better off when people explain away their poor results, which is, you know, we usually don't have a hard time explaining our positive results as our responsibility. We would have so much more learning. Mm-hmm. And so much better results, quite frankly. And the third one, maybe that I don't have enough time. I think a lot of people are competing to be the busiest person on the planet, and we're just mm-hmm. leaking potential everywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, it's to the point where it's like it's an adage, you know, like, hey, how's it going? Like, busy, busy. You know, like, what are we doing? You know? And so it seems like we're all leaking efficiency there. You'd be surprised at how much time you have for things you really care about.
100%. The last question comes from the title of a book called How Will You Measure Your Life? So if you could, it's 100 years from now, and you've left a set of instructions for an artist to create a piece, whether it's a sculpture or a painting, to depict your answer to that question, how will you measure your life? What would the instructions read?
How will you measure your life? I think I would, and I hope this isn't a cop-out, I think I would instruct the artist to, in the largest format possible, paint the word, what are you becoming, with a big question mark at the end. And I believe that anybody who would see that painting would be forced to look into a big mirror, and they would be forced to perpetually re-engage with themselves. And that would remove a lot of the sort of stagnation and the autopilot that we experience throughout our lives. And I bet that if you looked at that or engaged in that question on a daily or weekly or monthly basis for the entirety of your life, that people would do much more with it.
Logan, so powerful. Thank you so much for sharing your gifts with us today.
Thank you. It was awesome being on. Thanks.
Thank you to this week's guest, and thank you for listening. If you missed any of the key points and highlights from my conversation, we've got you covered over at theimpactentrepreneur.net/podcast for show notes to each and every episode. And while you are there, check out Flynn Wealth Strategies and Insurance Solutions. You can do that by visiting flynnwealthstrategies.com. The Lawton Marketing Group and the Podcast Masters. We could not do this show without them and with all of their support. Now, until next time, go make an impact.